two, this is side two of interviewing Dolores Wharton. We're talking about the student protests of the early 1970s on their first days on campus. Would you talk a little bit more, Mrs. Wharton, about the some of the Cowles Hall activities that you were involved in besides the student protests? What were some of the other activities you were involved in?
They were endless. They were endless. You had a quote in your book, 3,000 to 4,000. I'd say 5,000 a year went through Cowles House.
Okay.
All different kinds of receptions, student receptions. One of the things which I thoroughly enjoyed and loved was the invitations that were accepted by the artist that Ken Beechler had performing at the auditorium. And there were many a superstar who accepted, like Rudolf Nureyev,
Van
Cliburn, just a host of artists who would come. I would have them either, they did not like coming before the concerts,
mm-hmm.
and they would come afterward. Sometimes we'd have dinner, and sometimes Duke Ellington, for example, he would only stay for a reception. He didn't stay for dinner. But what I did was I invited the people from the community to come and meet these brilliant American performers, and they accepted the invitations. There was not a lot of interaction with the people in the community at that time. Not a lot, when we first went in. But when they did get invitations to meet some of these superstars, they accepted our invitations with great delight, and it started a program that was just thoroughly enjoyed. I loved it. Then, of course, we had the President's Club, which I started receiving at Cowles House. And
Widows?
Oh, yes, the Widows. I was told by...
And the new faculty
wife. Well, not to... That's another.
The Widows was an annual...
Yes, yeah. Yes, it was an annual event. They were widows of employees. The employees themselves had died, and there were a lot of widows in the community who felt as if they had nothing whatsoever to do with Michigan State anymore. It was over, and they were forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a number of them. Mrs. Mott, B. Mott, who was Cliff's secretary, she was terrific. And she helped me to identify these women all over the Lansing area. And I had programs for them, lunches for them, but I'm not so sure of them I didn't also take them on tours around the campus. I developed a number of tours around campus. I never knew that we had a mink farm.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the ladies to see the mink farm and all different kinds of things. And then there was a program at Fairchild and at the auditorium we had at the same time. We went backstage. I think we saw a performance. And we went backstage and we saw what our conditions were on both sides of the of both. They shared the common stage then. There were a lot of different things that we had. But usually I started out at Cowles House with some sort of a reception.
Mm-hmm. The auditorium was a WPA project.
Yes,
so it built.
Yes. Exactly.
And I think I recall I had my students over there when I'm talking about the Great Depression, and Eleanor Roosevelt was there at the christening,
yes,
of the building,
uh-huh,
in 1940, I think it was. But so at the time, 30 years, a whole generation later, when you were there, how would you describe in terms of the facilities? When what were your early reactions?
It was Spartan. the audiences turned out, though. Mm-hmm. Ken said that there was a travelogue series, and he said that was always packed. So the people did go out. I think that it was accepted. It was just accepted,
mm-hmm,
and the thought of a new performing arts center was just not in the cards. It just was not necessary. If you're going to do anything, it had to be for sports. There was a talk of a new sports arena, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and here this strange woman from New York wants a theater. That was not smiled upon.
Who would you say hatched the idea of a new center for the performing arts?
There had been a proposal made before we came, and that was in reaction to an earlier proposal before we came for an all events building. And the students got angry about the proposal for the all events, and they wanted a performing arts center. So there was a very rough proposal made, but then both of them died. So when we came, then the issue was stipulated.
I was very pleased to
You mentioned Ken Beechler.
Oh, yes.
So he was among those that was a strong supporter of a new facility. Any other faculty that you remember that were active in lobbying for a new facility?
You have to start.
Catlin and Perrin.
There was a committee. I asked Catlin to appoint a committee, and that committee was to look at performing arts facilities all over the United States and come forward with a set of recommendations. And Dolores was on that committee, along with Les and you go through the rest of it. But that committee's proposed set of recommendations.
And Garrison, Frank Rutledge, Ken, of course, Niblock.
Yeah.
I was pretty much
then it. Their recommendations formed the basis for the development of a genuine prospectus for the Performing Arts Center. That was all done under the aegis of John Cantlin. So when we decided to have a capital drive, and the Performing Arts Center was included in that, that's when we began the campaign on campus. And that was when Dolores and I went all over that campus before it was a public drive to speak to the different communities on campus, students and the grounds crew and you name it, departments. And what we said to them was, if you really want this, we have to contribute first before I can go out to the general public to get the money. And we spoke, I don't know how many times, the two of us, all over that campus.
Well, then we also stretched out and went across the country. I went on a number of speaking engagements by myself, actually. We went up to the West Coast.
The thing was, as I remember it, we set a target on campus to raise $500,000, and before we even got to the public launch with the Tony and Lena benefit, we'd already passed, I think, $750,000 or $800,000, way past a million on campus. So that I was then able to go to the public and say, look, we've already, our people have won this, been given, and so on. But that was when we really started the campaign.
Did you find that to be a tough sell at the time?
By that point, no. Not really. We worked hard. We worked very hard. A lot of people were saying it's a state university, it is not necessary to make private contributions. Now, today, everyone realizes state institutions do go out fundraising. But at that time, it was quite new. Mm-hmm. And that was the big argument that we ran up against.
Mm-hmm. While you were in the role of a presidential first lady at Michigan State, how else were you involved in the arts or in the performing arts?
I had been invited to serve on the board of trustees of the Museum of Modern Art here in New York City. I had been invited to be a council member of the National Endowment for the Arts when President Ford was president. It was observed that when he became president that there was no one representing the good state of Michigan. So my name had come up prior to that, but when Ford came in, my nomination just went right through, and I was appointed by Ford.
Did you know the Fords personally, or at that time?
No, not till later. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Ford came and spent the night with me when President Ford was at the University of Michigan, and he said that he was going to run for a second term. Mm-hmm. And he went to Michigan, and she came to Michigan State and spent the night with us in Cole's house. Mm-hmm. That was lovely.
Well, that's when you started going on corporate boards, though, after that.
After the appointment to NEA?
No, I was already on the Phillips board.
That's right. Okay.
No, that's not correct.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That's not correct. No, I was on Phillips and I think Kellogg at that point. No, Michigan Bell? No.
Within Carl's House on campus, did you do anything to support the local artists on at Michigan State?
Well, the paintings that I had in the house, it's one of them right now, right there, right now, I wish we bought. Yes, I was very, very proud of that. I had a program where I rotated art, I guess it was perhaps every term. The artists from the department, the studio professors, mm-hmm. brought their work to a particular classroom that they would allow to be donated to Cole's House. And Erling Browner was the head of the department. And he and I would go through the contributions, and we would select paintings that were hung in Cole's House. And we had, just marvelous shows, just wonderful shows. I was thrilled with them. There were times when we had over 50 pieces in the house. One of the artists from Kuala Lumpur was there, Jolly Ko, and he said that he had been over the art department. He'd heard about all the different artists who said they had paintings in Cole's House. He said, I thought this place was going to be clustered. He said, but the way you've done it is really quite beautiful. And it was well done. The house is big. It lent itself exquisitely to the art. It was very eclectic. So you had the contemporary art and the rather beautifully decorated designs that went traditionally into Cole's House. Mm-hmm. It had been beautifully done mm-hmm. before our coming. Mm-hmm. The furnishings were really just splendid. The architecture was I thought was great. So the combination was really quite wonderful. And the artists were most kind and gracious to me in letting me use their things.
Were any of the student art?
No.
And it was primarily faculty?
Totally.
Oh, I see.
That was my interest.
Uh-huh. The corporate boards that you just briefly mentioned, how was that developed?
The first one was with Michigan National Bank. I was invited to go on that. I was very pleased. That was a local board. There were a number of boards that I had served. I was the American Red Cross, and the governor had appointed me to various commissions and whatnot. And I had done my books. And with the students and the press and whatnot, I had a lot of visibility. I had become fairly well known there in Michigan at that mm-hmm. time. So with the visibility and with the understanding of what was going on the campus and having spoken out about it, I think under those circumstances, I was someone that the boards were interested. They were interested in having me, mm-hmm. and I received the first invitation. As I say, the corporate was Michigan National Bank, and then Michigan Bell, and then there was Kellogg and Phillips Petroleum, mm-hmm. and later, after we came to New York, I was invited to go into the Gannett board.
I see.
And Comsat.
Talking about the Horton Center, or what came to be called the Horton Center.
Oh, that was a great thrill. Greatest honor of our lives.
So you were involved in that after you left?
No.
Not in the naming, I don't mean that. I mean in raising the funds and talking about some of the development of the Horton Center. Were you involved at all after you left the university?
No. Uh-huh. I had a deep affection for it and hope that it was going to go well, but no, we were not. It was SUNY then, mm-hmm. and making that adjustment to the State University of New York.
Yeah. What was your reaction when you heard that the Board of Trustees was interested in naming it in your honor?
We were thrilled beyond words. Absolutely, for me it was the greatest single honor of my life. Bar none. I'm still ecstatic about it.
How did you feel when you walked into the Great Hall for the first time?
I was just overwhelmed with joy and delight, and the fact that it was so well received by the community. Oh, it was just the ultimate. It was just brilliant.
Your name is invoked many, many times by thousands of students and faculty.
Not who it is.
In a positive way. Where are we going
there's,
tonight?
There's some of those who think we're dead. You have a building name for it. You're supposed to be dead.
No, but the whole concept of going to the Horton Center is so significant. I introduced my daughter at age 5. We went to a show.
That's
in,
wonderful.
In 1986.
And
for her, that was exciting. And now she's a freshman at Michigan State.
Yes, that's great. That's
but
really
but
great.
I think that's important. And you know, seeing your name on the building, I think, is significant. What in the initial in do you remember anything about that the dedication?
We've got it on tape.
You
we have it
on
tape. Yes. Yeah. It's
pretty incredible.
The whole thing. I'm very seriously. I'm just not coming out with glowing words. It was the single most brilliant moment of my life. My husband was there, and so young Clifton wasn't there, but Bruce was there. Bruce was there. Yeah. Yes, he was. Friends from all over that campus. It was elevating. It was dazzling with joy and excitement and accomplishment and humility. But by George, you know, we pulled it off. It was just incredibly wonderful.
What did you learn from your experience at Michigan State?
I learned a lot more about my country. Now, you know, this goes back to the little thing with the Little Red Schoolhouse and how to look at your surroundings, your environment, your people, your society. And I'd been in Asia, and that was big time looking at different people. In the United States, it's pretty much New York. It wasn't, well, I shouldn't say it's exclusively to New York, because we had moved to Connecticut from New York when I was, you know, just at my teenage years. But Michigan was quite different for me. The Michigander has a real personality, really strong characteristics. And I think that was important to me in getting to know the people of Michigan, and then, of course, the people, broadening it to the people of the Midwest. It was learning about my country.
Did you have any?
I have just one question for you. When you came, you really did change the role of the First Lady at Michigan State University, because in the past, the person had not taken a particularly public role. How did you find that, and how did you find the reaction to that?
Could you be a little more specific as to which groups you're talking about?
You took a very public role as First Lady of Michigan State University, which had not been the practice.
Yes. No. Yeah. I understand that part. But were there any particular groups, or just in general?
No. I just wondered what groups you did find and how they reacted.
Well, just one day led to the next, kind of thing. It just happened. It just moved in that direction. And there were, I guess, throughout since Michigan State, there have been times when I have given a side of this coupling with Wharton, that I have a part that I play that is part of the totality of the two of us. And I was never discouraged from speaking out, being a part, making my comments. So that it just flowed. There were several times when Cliff was off campus, or when he was invited to make presentations and speeches and whatnot off campus, and he would have me go in his stead. Through my book, I'd done some radio broadcasts, television, and that kind of thing. So I had spoken before, and he had me speak, and I was speaking on campus. So one thing led to the other, and then I made one speech. I remember. Oh, Roman, Pam Roman. I made a speech someplace, I think it was over the Student Union. They had asked me to speak. I was always being asked to speak. And this is the first one. And then the title, the big headlines was, Mrs. Wharton Speaks. You know, otherwise, before that, I'd been dumb. Didn't speak any. But that kind of started it. Then after that, there were just a lot of invitations, more invitations than what I could actually fill.
I think one thing that's probably true is that, to a certain extent, since previous first ladies had not
perform this role. Dolores could almost make sense to design the whole thing on her own. There was no pattern, no model to follow. And there were, as she says, there were forces of circumstance which threw a lot of it. That is, for example, the giving the talks about what the students are like and what's happening on the campus. That's what was happening, so that's what you can talk about. And so those sorts of things encourage that kind of development. And the same thing, I think, is true in terms of the corporate boards. Having the base of experience and exposure to what the youth are thinking, what the youth are doing, and so on, was a tremendous resource for many corporate boards, particularly those who are at the state level. So
students were protesting a lot of major corporations.
Here's somebody who knows what it's like. It was more, and I felt that this was all positive. I didn't think that this was some sort of saying, well, stay at home and just, you know, be pouring tea. It just didn't make sense.
No, I never had a tea party.
Yeah, that's what the New York Times said.
I never had a tea party. But I loved Cole's house. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And every First Lady has her own approach. No matter who she is, she has her own approach. And my approach was different from others, and different from certainly what it is now. That was my house. I did not invite anybody.
Home.
And my home. It was not that I expected anybody to come and say it was the university's, and they had every right to do whatever they wanted to. I objected to that very, very much. I ran it. I was in charge of it. I was in control of it. And if there's going to be any change, I was going to leave. I kid you not. I would have left. I had student waiters whom I trained, and I told them if anyone dare set foot in that kitchen, they would tell them, by Mrs. Wharton's orders, no one is admitted into the kitchen. And in those first years, I had a lot of people going, trying to get into the kitchen to get their own drinks and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I even had one trustee. Yes, I did, who went into the kitchen. I was livid. You can't do that. You just can't. It's improper. It's rude. So it was my house, and when they invited to my house, it was by my invitation.
I want to thank you for the time that you've given us and the ideas that you've shared, and we appreciate your contributions to the project.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.